And now, welcome to Who's Talking on WCHL with D.G. Martin. Interesting guests, enlightening conversation. And now, here's your host, D.G. Martin.
Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. The new Southern Latino table, recipes that bring together the bold and beloved flavors of Latin America and the American South. Whew, that's the long title of Sandra Gutierrez. This is a new book. She grew up in the United States and in Guatemala. She's a culinary instructor, recipe developer, journalist, writer about food, all kinds of things. And we persuaded her to come join us to talk about her bicultural background and how that resulted in a rich blending of cooking traditions and your new book. Thanks for coming, Sandra.
Thank you for having
Gutierrez.
Me. Yes, Gutierrez.
A Spanish name because?
Because my husband's father's family hails from Spain. So that's where the name, there was actually a town of Gutierrez in Spain. But it's a very common name. It's like saying Smith in Latin America now. Of course, the Spaniards colonized Latin America in the 15th century. So Gutierrez is just one of those last names like Smith.
And then how about you? What was your last name before you got married?
My last name was Alfaro, which is, I guess it's a Moorish name, also from Spain. That's where that side of the family hails from. There's a town of Alfaro, also somewhere in Spain. But they were talking about, generations and generations back.
But identifiable culture. It's wonderful that the Spanish have that culture now. The Southern Latino table is part of your title. And so you're... But, I mean, Southern cooking and cooking south of the border is quite different, isn't it?
It is. It's quite different. But, once you start experimenting it and going out and seeing what's happening around you, you start recognizing it. You know, the idea for the book came up about 15 years ago. I was the food columnist for the Cary News. And I started noticing that chipotle peppers, being smoked jalapenos, they sell them in cans or dried.
It's what is
chipotle.
Chipotle.
Chipotle peppers, just like the chain chipotle.
What does that mean?
Chipotle is just the Aztec name or the Nahuatl name for the dried jalapeno that has been allowed to ripen, get red, and then they smoke dry it. It's really, really delicious. I'm going to have to cook with chipotles for you sometime.
I'll
introduce
that.
You. But I started noticing that was the first ingredient that I thought really made an inroad in the South. About 15 years ago, people were using it in mayonnaise. They were using it in their barbecue sauces.
So Southern, not historically typical with not, these hot, but more and more Southerners were accepting these hot
ingredients,
peppers,
and
into
spicy
their...
ingredients that were not traditional to the South, into the cuisine, and that just got my attention. I said, "Let's see how this is going to turn." I started teaching cooking here in the Triangle about 20 years ago, 17, 18 years ago, and my students were very much serious about, learning other cuisines when I first came. So I was teaching French cuisines and German cuisine and Spanish cuisine from Europe. And all of a sudden, there was this big interest in Latin American cuisine, which I had never seen before. Always, whenever I introduced classes in Latin cuisine, people would say, oh, Mexico.
Right, yeah.
Because that's the first thing everybody thinks of, tacos and Mexico. And it became my challenge and my mission to break the stereotypes that surround Latin cooking, because in reality, there are 21 different countries with 21 very different and exciting cuisines. So that
every country is different?
Every single country is different.
Your Southern Latino table, but it doesn't say Southern and 21 different countries. Are there elements of the Latino culinary encyclopedia that are common among those 21 countries that are historically not part of the Southern culture?
There are, but what I found was that when this movement began, and it became very noticeable about 5 or 6 years ago that it was happening, Southerners were starting to cook with more and more Latin ingredients, and Latinos were starting to use more and more Southern cooking techniques and ingredients. I started investigating as to why this could happen, and what I found was that we have a lot of similarities in the formation of our cuisines at their base. That is, that if you take the whole territory of the Southern region of the U.S. and bring us all down to Argentina and the bottom of South America, going through Central America and Mexico, what you find out that we share the same three ethnic groups forming our cuisines, the Native Americans, or indigenous people of the Americas, here the Native Americans, Mayas, Aztecs, Incas, etc., all the other indigenous groups in South America. The Europeans who came to colonize, and in both groups, there were the same groups of Europeans. They were the Spaniards and the Portuguese. Of course, the Spaniards get to Louisiana and to Florida and all that at the same time that they go into Latin America. And then the Africans. And very few people know that the Africans have a huge culinary influence in Latin America. It's something that is not known, really, that, and of course, here in the South as well. The second thing that I found is that we have the same ingredients at the base of our cuisines. Squash, pork, nuts, tomatoes, corn, chocolate. And the third thing that I discovered is that we use exactly the same culinary techniques. Braising, deep frying, of course. You can think of Southern food without thinking of deep fried, you know, chicken or something like that. And it's the same in Latin America. And finally, barbecue. And in my research, what I found interesting is that even though Southerners, we are so proud of our barbecue here, the technique for barbecuing is actually a technique that was discovered by Christopher Columbus in Latin America.
That's interesting. Yeah, that's interesting. Well, I think we should get out John Sheldon Rees' book on Holy Smoke, the book of North Carolina barbecue. I think he takes it back and credits that maybe even barbecue might be a Spanish word.
Barbacoa.
In Indian.
It was a Taino word.
Is that right?
It comes from the word barbacoa from the Taínos in what is now modern day Dominican Republic.
So it was an indigenous word that got
captured
as a part of Spanish and then brought here.
And the technique of cooking food directly over fire. Mm-hmm. Europeans used to cook everything either in water, boiled. You'll see all the boiled meats and a lot of that tradition in Europe, but not barbecue.
All right, now, I'm going to try to stay focused on this question about the either the similarities and the differences between mm-hmm. Southern cooking and the multi aspects of Latino cooking, because every country's got a different culture. But now, but you've persuaded me now that the Southern style of cooking is very similar to all of what's going on in Latin America.
But we interpret it very differently.
Here's where I want to go. All right, now what about when you get north of the Mason-Dixon line in the United States? Can we say that it's just us in Latin America that you can do this, and that those Yankees, they're just different from us?
It is a different cuisine. It is a different amalgamation of cultures, because up north what you get is the British coming in, you know, more of that Anglo-Saxon culture coming in, which is not common with the rest of the chain of mm-hmm. territories that I'm discussing here. And then the African-American influence up there is not as much as it was down here. Because here in the South, as well as in Latin America, the history of how Africans are forcefully brought into our territories really occurs when the Spaniards and the Portuguese are trying to control the sugar commerce, the market of sugar in Europe. Sugar was the highest commodity that you could get. It was, of course, the time when we hear about the spice wars in Europe and people trying to control the spice market in that part of the world. The old world had already been discovered. Asia and all that commerce was going back and forth, but nothing had been discovered here. And Spain sets out, as Portugal does too, to discover new territories, not only in search of gold and silver, which is what we've been taught in school. They were also interested in controlling the sugar exports into Europe. And they find that in Latin America, or the New World, as they call it when they discover it, is prime territory for growing sugarcane.
For the plantations for sugarcane.
And what happens is they come and they conquer what is now today modern day in Latin America, and they start killing the natives that live here, the indigenous people, both forcefully by, just exploiting them through hard work and labor, but also because they bring a lot of diseases and a lot of other things with them that they couldn't control. And so they, find a way to bring new work and new labor by bringing African slaves. And at the same time that the African slaves are brought here into the South, they're introduced into Latin America as well. Brazil by the Portuguese, and then almost every Latin American country had an influx of African slaves, and very few people know that. They become extremely important in the cuisine of Latin America because, and in the South, because most of the time they are in charge of the kitchen, of working in the kitchen, and they introduce what in Italy is known as cucina povera, what we know in Latin America as peasant food. And not only did the indigenous people, of course, who had the, probably the biggest influence in the ingredients and the basis of the cuisine in Latin America, but they also add all of these elements of ingredients that are now very common to the area that didn't exist before. Yams, cowpeas, or black-eyed peas, for instance.
All both in Latin America and in the South.
And in the South. So we get this other chain that is not present in the Northeast or the West Coast.
I've got so many questions. Let's take a quick break. I'm visiting with Sandra Gutierrez.
Yes.
Is that close enough?
You got it.
You got it. She's the author of The New Southern Latino Table. She and I'll be right back.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. We're talking about Latino food, Southern food, and the blending of them, as discussed in a wonderful new, I don't want to call it a cookbook. It's a book about eating, though, and it's called The New Southern Latino Table. Sandra Gutierrez is my guest and the author of that book. We're talking about how these different food traditions have been blended. Can we get back to the blending of what's happening right before our very eyes as we live?
Yes.
As Southern Americans started adopting the food preparation techniques that they've learned about in Central America and South America. How's that happening?
What happened is that if you look at the history of the U.S. and the big cities that got huge waves of immigration, you know, let's talk about Los Angeles, New York City, Chicago, these cities have had, you know, groups of immigrants coming in now for over a century. That's not the case here in the South. The South remained pretty hermetically sealed for many, many, many years, decades and decades and decades. But in the 1960s, Latinos start moving into Florida, fleeing really from civil wars and political circumstances in their countries.
Mainly Cuban, but others as well?
Cubans. In Florida, you first see the Cubans, and then you see in the 70s, late 70s, early 80s, a huge influx of Colombians and Venezuelans coming up into Florida, Nicaraguans coming in as well. And as each American country starts finding strife, a lot of the people who had the means to escape to Florida start moving into Florida, mostly
so these are
Texas as
well. Largely people who are trying to get away from
political strife.
From danger.
Yes.
And not primarily for economic reasons.
The first immigrants that came from Latin America in that time period, they were running away from civil problems and war and danger. But in the recent, I'm going to say the last two decades, we have found, in the last decade really here in North Carolina would be a good example, we have found the economic strife of Latin Americans now start driving them to coming up here and working. So we get these huge migrant workers groups coming in to
work
the land.
We think of them as Mexicans, but is it more varied than that?
It is more varied, and that's the interesting thing. That's what makes this movement, not only the real movement, but the culinary movement so interesting. Is that it differentiates from that which happened in the Southwest, where it was a Mexican-driven movement. Here, we're getting people from all over Latin America coming, but we're not only getting the migrant workers. We're getting the more educated Latin Americans, second-generation even Latin Americans coming into the South and establishing their homes here. People from Argentina, people from Peru, people from Bolivia. Even the Cubans have continued to trek into the South. I was so surprised last year. I went to on my book tour to Nashville to find out that there's a huge Cuban colony there, just a huge group of Cubans that are making inroads in the food. And what happens is that Southerners and Latinos start relating to each other. We have this huge commerce, all the tiendas, the Latin American stores popping up all over our landscape. I mean, you can see them here in Chapel Hill. You can see them all over from Washington all the way down.
We drive by in Chapel Hill and Carver and see the tienda.
Yes.
And we think, well, that's for Mexicans, or that's not for me. But in your book, you say you got to go stock up with some of those things that you can get in the tienda. Why should I go visit a tienda?
It is like a little field trip. And it's a lot of fun to go to tiendas. I actually take some students in field trips once in a while to see tiendas for several reasons. One, I think that most of them, as you say, Mexico, that's the first country you think of. Most of the tiendas may be owned by Mexicans, but because the realities that many of us are coming from different areas of Latin America, they really cater to Central and South Americans as well. So the variety of ingredients is great. But also, not all tiendas are created equal. So some can be very, very little and very simple. And then you have these mega stores, just mega stores, the size of a Walmart or bigger, that you walk in and it's aisle by aisle divided in different Latin countries. So you can see what Brazilians are cooking.
Now, where is that? Where is one of those?
There's several here I can think of. One of them is Compare, which is pretty big. Don't go by my directions.
No, we won't, but it's close by.
It's close by. It's in Durham.
Durham.
Okay. And I know they have one in Winston-Salem as well. And there is some store called International Foods in Raleigh. And then there are a lot of little stores. I have one near Apex that is not that big. It's more like a regular supermarket called Galaxy that I love to stop by. Some of them carry unbelievable produce from all over the world. So you can find bananas in all different colors, purple, you know, black bananas, big bananas, little bananas.
Now, it's like what attracted me, Sandra Gutierrez. Gutierrez.
It's my husband's fault.
I know. And it's a great name. Is that they're small and they remind me of the little stores that we used to have in the South.
Yes.
Before the big supermarket chains came in. And it might be one old guy who ran the store and he ran it his way. But it looks like it's just an extension of the personality of an individual rather than a corporate model that's imposed from, you know, somewhere on high.
It is. It's almost like a little pocket into, you know, an era that's gone.
Well, if I wanted not to be, excuse me for getting off base here. But if I wanted to walk in and not be dumb, mm-hmm. can't speak Spanish, I'd just say, Quiero.
Cerveza, of course. Everybody knows cerveza.
Yeah. Cerveza. Oh, so I have a different kind of beer?
All sorts of beers, depending where you are.
A different kind of beer. Or what would I do so that it wouldn't just be obvious that I didn't know what I was doing?
Well, the first thing you need to do is get a copy of my book. Because at the end of my book, I included a chapter called How to Navigate a Latin Tienda.
Well, tell us. Give us a little preview of your book.
It's a 4 or 5 page chapter. It's very small, but I tell you exactly what kinds of things you will find depending on what area of the store, because even though they're not created equal, they all have the same departments. So you have the produce department, the bakery, the butcher department. I give you a fair warning about the butcher sections in tiendas, because American butcher sections in the supermarket, everything comes wrapped very pretty in
this
little trays.
This is
going to
be brutal. This is like
be prepared to see the whole tongue and to see, you know, a whole hog's head in the refrigerator. You know, don't be scared. That's part of culture. I mean, the first time when I asked them, where does steak come from? And they said, the supermarket. I said, we need a field trip. You need to
go to the tienda.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. To show them what a cow looked like and where the piece of meat was coming from. So that's part of it. The bakery section is interesting, depending what kind of tienda you walk into. If they're Mexican, they will have the big tortas and the big sweet, delicious breads that you eat with, you know, their lard-based breads. But if you go to one that has more of an Argentinian flair, and there is one in Chapel Hill that was selling these beautiful cookies called alfajores that are, they're a sandwich cookie, like an Oreo. Mm-hmm. Think of it as an Argentinian mm-hmm. Oreo, but the outside is white and the inside is dulce de leche, which is caramel.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll find different things that are really delicious to eat. What I like to do, the way that I thought of this book is I want to introduce people to the different cuisines of Latin America. See how they come together, where our dishes become bridged, how we can both sit at the table. You as a Southerner, me as a Latina, sitting down together to a meal, and I serve you a dish, let's say, for instance, a casserole. And you recognize it as a casserole, But me, the Latina, would recognize it as chilaquiles, which is a Mexican tortilla dish. And it's the way that I compose it. You recognize it. I recognize it. We start eating it. We both feel that we've tasted this before. And we start a conversation. That was the idea of the book. It's bring people together through similarities.
Well, is the idea to bring people together through the charm of these new dishes that you introduce, or to celebrate the coming together that's already happened?
It's to celebrate what's happening already. I'm not inventing this cuisine. I am the first person to document it. But I'll tell you something interesting. I love going to Crook's Corner here in Chapel Hill. And Bill Smith has a huge kitchen, you know, with people who come from all over Latin America. I think mostly Mexico. I was so surprised to go to the southern Mecca, as, you know, Crook's Corner is, you know, to
right.
have my pulled pork.
So you go to the southern, and there in the kitchen, there are a whole bunch of Latinos
yes.
Cooking it.
And Bill is making tamales, and he's serving you the best tamales that you can even imagine. And just a few weeks ago, he was making sweet potato tamales. I mean, that's the ultimate marriage of cultures right there. The southern sweet potato, you know, meshed with the corn dumpling of Latin America and put together on a plate in the south in a southern restaurant being eaten by southerners.
That's great, but except that you persuaded me that the sweet potato was really Latino, at least originally.
But not used in tamales.
Not in tamales. Okay. So,
you know,
we took your tuber. I guess sweet potato is a tuber too.
It is like potato, like a root vegetable.
And we did you one better by putting it in your tamale.
Yeah, and it's happening everywhere that you go. You'll go to the thing about this DG is that the movement did not start in restaurants; it started in people's homes, and that's why I don't call it a fusion, because fusion was created by chefs. This is people, my students in cooking classes, coming to me and saying, "You know, you taught us how to make that mojo, which is a Cuban marinade with citrus and cumin and olive oil and garlic," and I said, "Yes. Well, now." We're marinating our shoulder before putting it in the smoker with this mojo. So people are just assimilating.
So you're arguing that this is not down, top down from the high-level
it's
chef.
It's from down
it's,
to the top.
Ground up. From,
correct.
And that the top chefs are having to adapt to what's already happened in somebody's
correct.
Kitchen.
The chefs are now adapting it in their restaurants, but we're already doing it. If you ask Latinos, you know, do you eat casseroles? Oh, yeah, we eat casseroles. Casseroles, in fact, that was probably my favorite chapter to write in the book, because when I first came to the South as a young bride, I was invited to a potluck dinner. I had no idea what that meant. The lady called me and said, "You're new in town. We would love to have you over for dinner. We're 16 people. Please bring something." So I arrived with dinner for 16 people. And I had no idea what potluck meant.
I love the part in your book where you say, you know, this is a great Southern tradition. You said that it's a fine tradition, but it marginal in. In Latin America, it would be insulting if you were.
Yeah, you would, if you were asked to bring dinner for the people who are hosting you, it would be insulting to the host, you know, because that would probably mean that the host could not cater to you as their guest. But it makes sense, you know. Casserole here denotes conviviality and friendship and comfort.
You
take it to a funeral.
So what do you do with casseroles in your book? Do you just reproduce what the casseroles that developed in Latin America or the Southern casseroles, or what do you?
I bring them together. For instance, I'm going to say one of my favorite casseroles, the potato salad of the South.
Oh, I remember the
egg
and potato
yes.
salad. Tell us about that dish.
So the southern potato salad is your eggs with your potato, your mayonnaise, your olives, et cetera. Mm-hmm. My favorite southern. Can you imagine a church supper without potato salad, right?
Right.
So I decided to build it up as a casserole because in Peru, potato salads are built up as casseroles. They're called causas. And they're either made into tiny casseroles or into large casseroles that you just cut into slices. So I built mine in that style. So I'm bringing the flavors of the South and setting them up in a Latin American fashion so that, again, the Peruvian would recognize it
so
as
it's
a
layered.
Causa. It's layered.
And what are the layers?
So you have a layer of potatoes that has been mashed with lime and the Peruvian pepper called ají amarillo, which is a yellow, which is why you have to go to the tienda. It's a delicious pepper, very pungent, spicy, but not overly spicy. And there's no mayonnaise in the potatoes. But you make your typical, your classic egg salad and put that in the middle with your mayonnaise and your chopped eggs.
You got the mayonnaise in the egg salad.
In the egg salad. And then you top it again with another layer of the potato. And you decorate it with the olives.
Right, and you squeeze it all together.
You layer it so right. that...
So you can slice it.
You can slice it.
All right, but then do you cook it or cool it?
You just refrigerate it, and it automatically just...
It settles down and gets heavy. Body so you can slice it.
Exactly.
You don't have to push it down.
Nothing.
Like
you don't have to press on. And those are very common in Peru, actually. That's how they eat it. They stuff them with any mayonnaise-based salad.
Now, what is a southerner going to think about this the first time he or she encounters this? Like, is he going to say, oh, this is just like what Mama fixed, or is it?
I think so. They're going to go, this is something I've had before, but with a twist. For instance, my fried chicken. I could not have a book representing the South, because it's a book that celebrates Southern cuisine as much as it celebrates.
I'm going to interrupt you. I'm sorry to do this, but I'm way over time. But when we're going to come back, we're going to talk about Southern fried chicken in Latina style.
Okay.
I'm visiting with Sandra Gutierrez, and I just have to pause after to be sure I say that every time. She's the author of The New Southern Latino Table, and she and I'll be right back.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. We're talking about Southern food and Latino food. And we're talking with the author of The New Southern Latino Table, subtitled Recipes That Bring Together the Bold and Beloved Flavors of Latin America and American South.
I know, it's a mouthful.
Sandra Gutierrez. And you're just teaching me so much. We promised that we'd talk about fried chicken.
Fried chicken.
Back.
You can't have a cookbook that celebrates Southern food and not include a recipe for fried chicken. What people don't know is that fried chicken is also very popular in Latin America.
Is it different?
Is it different? It's different. We do not use the same spices, but it's the same idea. Battered chicken, fried, you know, and enjoyed with whatever sides you like. Different from here. We don't have the hush puppies. We don't have. But we do have different kinds of slaws without mayonnaise. Eaten all throughout Latin America as well. So you're normally going to have your fried chicken served with some kind of slaw, either beet slaw or a cabbage slaw without any mayo in it. So I wanted to make a recipe that both Southerners and Latinos would identify with. And what I did was combine my base for the brine of my chicken is a buttermilk brine that I have seasoned with spices, and I have a...
So you let the chicken soak in that for a little bit?
Soak in it with... And it has
like
cilantro for 24 hours, or overnight at least. And it has cilantro in it, and it has spices like paprika in it. And, of course, it has a little bit of chile in it, because you need to have a little bit of spice. And then after that, I will batter it very quickly in self-rising flour. I do not use all-purpose flour, which most cooks will do, because I find that self-rising flour creates a very crusty crunch. And it's a beautiful, beautiful batter to have outside on the chicken. It just stays crispy for longer. And then I use the Latin American way of frying, and that's where it differs.
Tell us.
A Southerner will fry their chicken from start to end in the oil. In Latin America, what you do is you start the fry in the oil, and then you set your chicken in on top of a baking sheet that has been layered with a cooling wrap.
Not on paper. You don't
not
let us
paper.
Do it on
you
paper.
You never do any fried food on paper, and I'll tell you that in a moment. And then you put this half-fried chicken in a very hot oven to blast it. And what does...
Like 500?
Like 450, uh-huh. 400 degrees. And what that does is that the oil first goes in and it does the first fry. And then when you put it in this rack that I teach you how to do in the book, it's very easy. Just a baking sheet with a cooling rack, a metal cooling rack on top. And you set your chicken on top. And you heat it in a very hot oven, the oil comes back out, and it renders out of the chicken again, and it fries from the inside out.
So it's really sealed. All that good stuff is sealed.
So it's sealed your crust is crunchy on the inside and the outside.
So it's better.
And it's moist.
Better than Southern fried chicken.
I can't say anything's better. I don't go against the grandmothers in the South, let me tell you. But it's different, and it works.
And it's got a breaded, it's like the Colonel Sanders got some secret spices and everything that are attached now as
Correct.
Part of the sealant.
So you have it in the brine and you have it in the crust, different spices in the crust as well. And I'll tell you, my test for this recipe was I had my friend Virginia Willis, who's the author of Bon Appetit, Y'all. She's a true Southerner, Georgia girl, over for dinner. And she watched me do this chicken, and every once in a while she'd say, that's not how my mama does it. And I'm getting really nervous. And then she tried that chicken, and she said, oh my, this is some of the best fried chicken I've ever had in my life. And I thought, okay, it can go in the book now.
That's great. Well, you can test on me. But now, you've certified to us that your recipes are bottom-up driven.
Yes.
And not chef and top-down, mm-hmm. but you took this recipe. You developed it. This is not a bottoms-up recipe. This is your recipe.
Yes. I developed the recipes, but I teach cooks how to cook. I'm not a chef. I'm not restaurant trained. I'm a cook who writes about food and who teaches about food. So because I'm teaching the normal, regular home cook, Mr. America and Mrs. America every day in my classes, my recipes are developed for your kitchen, for them to work, and also very practical.
So you're not a top-down driver. You're a follower of what's happening and helping people do what they want
to
do.
I would like to think that I'm the communicator, that I'm the bridge that makes, I'm able to translate the recipe for you to be able to do it at home successfully. And my cooking classes have been very, very popular throughout the years because of all the tips that I give my students. What can you prepare ahead of time? How long?
Let's take another break.
Okay.
And we'll come back and talk about some tips, including your big tip of using self-rising flour in all kinds of things. Sandra Gutierrez and I will be right back.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. We're talking about Southern cooking and Latino cooking and how they've come together. It's all in the context of a new book by Sandra Gutierrez, and it's a book published by UNC Press. It's called The New Southern Latino Table, and I'm just learning so much. One of the things that you talked about in this wonderful way, this fried chicken, let me just mention about the book is available. If you're too poor to buy the book, you can go to the UNC webpage about the book, and you can get a link to Sandra's webpage and blog. And Sandra, you share a lot of these tips for free on your website. So we'll have a link to that, but you can give it if you remember it.
It's www.sandraskitchenstudio.com.
Okay. Sandraskitchenstudio.com. That's just all one word and no apostrophe. But we'll have that on the Chapelboro link. And we're talking about self-rising bread. One of the things that you do so nicely is in introducing people like me, kind of sucking us in to say it's easy. It's easy. Here's some things you can do easy.
It is
hardest,
easy.
Hardest thing in the world is to make good biscuits.
Yes.
But you say you can do that if you'll follow these directions.
Well, I learned from the mums and the grandmas of my friends. I would go to the kitchen and say, teach me. I feel that your fingers have memory. So the more that you can practice, the better it is. But you always start with self-rising flour. And then you add the fat, which I prefer to use lard, because it adds the best flavor.
Lard is like Crisco?
Crisco is shortening. And in a rush, if in a pinch, you can use shortening.
Lard. Bad's got a bad name.
I'll tell you what. The lard that you find that's hydrogenized in the tubs that we find in the supermarket is awful. But if you go to a Latin tienda, you will find freshly rendered lard that has not been put through the process of hydrogenization. And that's pretty good for us. You shouldn't eat lard every day, just like you shouldn't eat bacon every day.
If you want to make good biscuits, good flaky biscuits.
Lard, I think, is the secret.
You can
also render your own lard. You just get stricoline or you get your pieces of fat and fat back in the supermarket. I get it all the time and I render my own lard by just cooking it slowly and letting it melt. And then you just keep it in your refrigerator for about a year and it lasts you. And you need a little bit of lard. I like to cut that very, very cold into my pastry, into my flour. And then I add the liquid.
So you got your self-rising flour. It's in a bowl.
In a bowl. You
put
add
your
the lard.
Which you got to buy at the tienda if you can't, don't have the pastry.
Or, you know, a combination of butter and shortening or butter, if that's what you have. Any kind of fat will do. Even duck fat will do. And then you just break it down either with your hands or with a pastry cutter until it resembles coarse sand.
All right. Now, you have a problem with your hands.
I do. My hands are too warm. I'm a warm-blooded Latina, so I use a pastry cutter. I prefer to use that.
Good. I'm sorry. This is so basic for everybody else, but for me,
you don't melt the fat.
You got to be careful because if you're in there warming it up, it's not going to work as well.
No, because you want the fat to stay cold because that's what's going to melt slowly in the oven when the biscuits go in. You want cold fat, hot oven, and what happens when the fat melts and it has little molecules of fat is that it creates steam. And that's what creates layers and flakiness in the biscuit. So after you mix in your liquid, which would, in my case, I prefer to use buttermilk, but it could be cream, it could be heavy cream, it could be milk. Then you just go ahead and dump it in a board, very quickly pat it down into a circle or whatever shape you want of the thickness that you want your biscuits to be.
And just roll it once or twice. I mean, you're not going to
30-second rule. That's it. That's what my friend's moms would say. 30-second rule.
Because I'm going to be rolling it all to get a perfect
I don't even
edge.
Roll it. I don't even get a
you
rolling
don't,
pin.
You just,
I don't. I just,
you just pat it and
pat
and
it
move.
Down, shape it down, cut it, and there's the next trick. You never twist your cutter when you're cutting down
Why
the
not?
Biscuits. If you twist your cutter, you pinch the edges together, and that causes the biscuits to stick on the edges, and it won't rise. So you just go up
or it won't
and
rise
down.
On the edges. So you got a little cramping
it just
there.
It won't rise
at all.
At all. It will stay like little hockey pucks flat. So you just cut up and down with your cutter, keep it very well floured, and then transfer your biscuits to an ungreased sheet. If you want them to be crispy.
Well, it's going to stick to the Don't you want to?
It won't because it has so much lard
in
it.
Aluminum foil there too?
I would put parchment paper if you're afraid of them sticking, but they won't stick. Trust me.
Right.
If you use my recipe, they won't stick.
Okay. All right, just put it on an ordinary
baking sheet or a round aluminum baking pan. Edges touching if you want them to be soft, and edges separated if you want the whole biscuit to be crispy outside. So if you like more of a crusty biscuit, don't let the biscuits touch in the baking sheet. And then you with your thumb, do a slight indentation on top of the biscuit.
Just barely.
I don't know why that works, just a bare indentation, but the mothers swear that the biscuits will rise.
All right, now.
And they do.
This is in the Southern Latino table, but this is Southern. This is not Latino, is it?
That's because I like to say that 20-some years ago when I moved here to the South, the Latina found her Southern belle within. And
was it magic. Was it biscuits that did it?
It was pimento cheese and fried green tomatoes that did it first. I fell in love with that, with grits, with biscuits. And I wanted to be home. This was my new home. My children are Southern Latinas. It is their food. It is the food that they grew up with. And it's what many of us Latinos are eating in the South. And what made this book possible is that it's what many Southerners are also adapting in their homes. So this is not a way of replacing Southern food. This is my celebration of both cuisines coming together in the same territory and melding.
Well, now we've got time for you to talk about pimento cheese. And I'll lead you just a little bit because we are a little bit short on time. And that was that what I love... I love cheddar cheese and I love mayonnaise.
Yes.
And so
and pimentos.
And pimentos help, but there is one thing that I didn't know, and that was that not all cheddar cheese is alike, and that if I get it shredded, it might be better to shred it myself.
I prefer to shred it myself because when you get the shredded kind, look at it closely in the bags in the supermarket and you'll see white residue around the cheese. Sometimes that is, you know, cornmeal or other flours that they put. Sometimes they even do a little bit of sawdust residue just to not make it stick to each other. So the strands will stay separate.
An ingredient, a non-sticking to it, which would make it less attractive in the bag.
What it does is it changes the chemistry of the cheese.
I mean, if it were all it would just become a blob. And then it wouldn't look good. And so they put something in to keep them from coming back together.
Correct.
And that's not necessarily good for
I don't think that's good for any recipe, really, because it changes the chemistry. You're adding an extra ingredient there that you don't need. And I'm a purist. I believe in cooking everything from scratch. So shredding cheese, really, is something so easy to do.
Other than your instruction to shred it yourself rather than taking advantage of the pre-shredded, it's pretty simple.
It's your very basic.
All right, now, so shred your own cheddar cheese, sharp or?
Whatever you prefer. I love sharp cheddar cheese.
Okay, sharp cheddar and mayonnaise. Now, mayonnaise, not all mayonnaise is alike. You have a prejudice about
mayonnaise. I love Duke's mayonnaise. Once you're in the South, I don't know. Everybody, depending what area in the country you're from, you'll have your preferred brand of mayonnaise. But I'm a Duke's mayo girl. I love it because it has no sugar in it. It's just more flavored like the one that you would make at home.
Okay, that's commercial for Duke's. Then what about the pimentos?
The pimentos just store bought pimentos or roast your own peppers, because pimento really means pepper in Spanish, pimiento. That's exactly where the word comes from, pimiento, which means red bell pepper. So if you want to roast your own, that's fine. I just buy the one in the jar. I think it's an underutilized ingredient.
Don't have to go to the end to do that.
No,
you can get that in any. All right, and then what else do you do? You got a little extra stuff.
Well, I have that traditional southern pimento cheese, which is very basic.
All right, if you want to go Latino, you got on side by side.
You have some peppers, you have some red onion in it, you have some of the hot sauce in it, and mix it all together.
This is not a Latino dish. This is a southern dish that's been Latinoized.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just, you know, blending together the cultures, finding themselves in the plate.
I believe I could talk to you all day.
Oh, I would love to talk to you more.
The bell's ringing. And we've been talking about this exciting kind of concept of the coming together, which all of us have watched, about the blending of cultures between the Latinos who are moving into our area and our old southern ways of cooking, all brought together by our guest, Susan Gutierrez, in her book, The New Southern Latino Table. And Sandra, thank you so much for visiting with us.
DG, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks to you for listening. And this has been Who's Talking? And I'll be back here before you know it.